The next case is 04752, Corporex Development and Construction Management versus Shook, Inc. Mr. Curry.
Good morning. May it please the court, Chief Justice Moyer, counsel. My name is Mike Curry with Thompson Hine here representing the appellant Shook, Inc. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time.
Watch your time.
The court's decision in this case will have dramatic consequences not only in Ohio's construction industry, but on commerce as a whole in the state of Ohio. This case involves the application of the economic loss rule, which generally prohibits a party from recovering purely economic damages in tort. We hear very frequently that Ohio is viewed as being hostile towards business. The economic loss rule is absolutely essential to commerce in order to maintain the distinction between contract law and tort law.
Counsel. We're here on pleadings, and I'm having a hard time understanding. Could you tell us where your client is in terms of the dispute about the failure to do their work in a workmanlike fashion? There are allegations, the pleadings, that the building wasn't plumb, it wasn't straight and level, that there were several matters that were not done as required by the specifications. Was your client paid in full for everything that that they billed, or is there just a dispute? Because your client took a lien on the property, did it not?
That's correct, Justice Pfeiffer. I think that the answer to that question is this. There are allegations that the work did not conform in some manner to the specifications. However, I think the critical issue that the court needs to evaluate is that there is no claim in this case relating to property damage. The only claim made by the plaintiff in this case is for purely economic
damages.
Well,
was your client paid in full for everything they invoiced?
No, they were not.
So there's still a dispute about that?
That is correct.
And is that in this litigation?
That is in this litigation. There is the tension between was it done in accordance with the plans and specifications, or are the defects the result of the design?
Okay, so how does one sue for that if the pleadings are wrong here? What's wrong? The Court of Appeals sent it back. They said the trial court's right in knocking out certain claims, but they allowed certain claims to go back beyond the pleading stage. And there seems to be, your client says we haven't been paid for everything we were due, and you have a quantum merit claim bouncing around in this, or did?
Well, there is a claim for additional compensation for the delays on the project, but the answer is that the plaintiff here, the owner of this facility, has a contractual cause of action against the general contractor relating to this work. The general contractor, in turn, has a contractual cause of action against my client as the subcontractor. Contracts in this case, as in every construction case, provide for the remedies. These are risks that the parties knowingly allocated during the course of bargaining for the contracts.
Well, what about Section K? The subcontractor shall guarantee his work and materials for a minimum of 1 year after completion and final acceptance of the work by owner, DSI, and shall repair or correct any deficiencies that develop during the prescribed period without cost. Now, that seems to set up a direct connection between your client and the owner. And that would seem to get to what's part of what's at issue. Now, we can argue about the lost profits for the hotel opening late, but what I'm interested in is how does the owner assert their claims, if not the way they did, for allegations that your client's work was not done in a workmanlike fashion. And we don't know. These are just pleadings.
Well, in the first place, Section K of the contract has no applicability to the instant dispute, because that is common industry language that refers to defects that appear in the work after the owner takes occupancy of the project. You get a one-year warranty. That's not what this case is about. There have been no claims made by Dublin Suites in this case that Shook is to come back and correct anything. All of those items were taken care of before this owner took occupancy of the facility. In fact, in this case, the contract between the owner, DSI, and Corporex provides that if the owner makes final payment, it is a waiver of any and all claims. DSI, in fact, made final payment to Corporex in this case. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't ongoing one-year warranty obligations.
So your client gets the benefit of that?
Following the chain of privity, that is correct.
Okay.
In this case, DSI and Corporex both sued Shook, correct?
That is correct.
And the lawsuit really doesn't concern the Corporex claims against Shook. That still stands, does it not?
Those do still stand, Your Honor.
So we're really concerned as to whether DSI has a direct action against Shook, which is what the Court of Appeals seemed to allow.
Yeah, the sole focus is whether DSI can assert tort claims around the general contractor and against the subcontractor.
Because Corporex still has its viable action pending against Shook, which it has to prove. Shook has its counterclaim against Corporex for the outstanding mechanics lien. Those still pending, correct?
Correct.
And if Corporex recovers, DSI has an action against Corporex for what it claims are its damages?
Well, yes. In fact, what happened initially, DSI asserted no claims against the general contractor. They sued as co-plaintiffs against the subcontractor. The court's rulings, in essence, forced DSI to, in fact, follow the chain of privity and assert its claims against Corporex. Now, interestingly, the same lawyer that filed those claims by DSI against Corporex filed the answer by Corporex admitting liability and waiving all its affirmative defenses, but that's an issue for another day.
Well, I'll ask your opponent, but it seems to me that if Corporex recovers against your client, they can go after Corporex. Even though they're interlocking agencies, they can still transfer funds back and forth if Corporex recovers against Shook.
DSI absolutely has the right to go against Corporex and has done so, and Corporex in turn has filed a third-party complaint against Shook.
But you argue that that's all a sham. So you want to ignore that anyway.
No, we don't seek to ignore privity of contract in this case at all. I think all we're saying is that the explanation for why DSI seeks to assert a tort claim against Shook rather than following the chain of privity of contract and asserting its claims against the Corporex is the commonality of ownership between DSI on the one hand and Corporex on the other hand, because after all, if they sue each other.
But what I'm saying is, so they assert it and they get a judgment, or Corporex confesses judgment, and then your argument is, oh, that's all a sham, because it's the same owner, same lawyer, the whole thing, so it doesn't affect us.
I don't think we're arguing that that's a sham. I think the issue there is, if Corporex simply rolls over and admits liability and raises no affirmative defenses, it raises a significant legal question whether they are then entitled by contract or common law to any right of indemnity or contribution when they have given up an absolute bar to the claim that DSI had. They have
so
an
what,
absolute
what
defense.
Word other than sham would you apply to that?
I think sham is a good word in the way that it has worked out. I don't think a party, whether they're related or not, can waive an absolute defense they have to another party's claim for the sole purpose of passing that on to a third party. I don't think that's what we're here about today, but I do think that is problematic and will be addressed by, I'm sure, the lower courts when we get to those issues.
Counsel, I have a question with respect to the negotiations. You had stated that the parties were negotiating regarding whether Shook would take on the responsibility of any delay loss. and you said specifically that was struck from the contract. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. So this issue was broached by the parties ahead of time, and there was a specific agreement contractually that this, that Shook would not be liable.
Yes. During the phase of negotiations of the subcontract between Corporex and Shook, the draft subcontract form included provisions that would have made Shook liable for delay damages of the owner. That was lined through in the contract and initialed by both parties.
Yeah, police says we should not consider that, that that's, that was negotiating between the parties. What's your response?
My response to that is I think that's a fairly unsupportable ruling by the court. The fact of the matter is the contract was attached to the pleadings. This is not a circumstance where you're bringing in parole evidence to try and explain that. On the face of the contract, you have those provisions lined out and initialed by both parties. That in and of itself is a written agreement that is part of what is before the court. So I don't think that the court below's finding that it could not consider that was logical or supported by Ohio law. And in fact, if you look at the United States Supreme Court's opinion in the carbon fuel case, a very similar circumstance involving a Teamsters contract, the court specifically said that it would consider that and that the contractor in that case could enforce that provision as against an unrelated third party.
Counsel, the Murray Law Firm filed an interesting amicus brief taking no sides, but indicating that there is other confusion or that lower courts are not understanding the holdings of our cases. And that seemed to focus on the issue of whether or not, for example, someone in privity with you can bring tort actions when they also have a contract with you. What's your take on that?
I don't believe that where the parties are in direct privity of contract, that tort law has much of a role in most circumstances in providing a remedy. There are certain circumstances.
Well, much of a role or no role. Mr. Murray argues that some courts are taking a position if there's a contract, then there's no role for a tort claim, and that seems to go beyond the holdings of this court.
Well, I don't know that it does. The majority of jurisdictions have recognized that in particular circumstances, professional negligence, fraud, business misrepresentation, that a tort cause of action will lie because the only damages recoverable in those circumstances are economic loss. I believe that's essentially what this court held in 1982 in the Haddonview case, was that there are going to be those very limited circumstances where a tort cause of action will lie. Now,
well, let's take your case. You've got a contract with the general contractor. If your client just totally screwed up the building and caused enormous delay, not the, necessarily the facts of your case, but if that happened and there was no provision bargained for that said your client is not to suffer damages claim for delay in occupancy of the building. A tort claim appropriate?
Absolutely not. That is why we have contracts.
So if the contract—
In your example, PSI would have had the right under the contract to bring a contractual cause of action directly against Corporex, its general contractor, provided what's in their contract. They allocated the risk of that type of loss.
No, I'm asking a question that leaves DSI out. Say the general contractor could not bring that if the owner would be making the claim in the first place. So,
right, the owner would make the claim against the general contractor. The general contractor might have its own cause of action for its own delay costs contractually against the subcontractor. And in these circumstances, typically that's exactly what happens. The owner asserts a claim against the general contractor, who then asserts a claim against one or more subcontractors.
And if the contract is silent?
If the contract is silent, then they're going to be entitled to their actual damages that arise from the breach. If the contract avoids damages, then there is a limitation of liability. To use your example, let's assume outside the construction context, we have a contract that contains a provision whereby the purchaser waives the right to collect consequential damages by contract. So the person supplying the goods, let's say, thinks that they have a waiver of consequential damages. If you take what the 10th District Court of Appeals did in this case and apply it to that factual scenario, then that waiver of consequential damages, for which the purchaser got a lesser price, is gone, and the provider of the product has ultimate liability in tort for the very thing that they took out of their contract. That's why we have the economic loss doctrine. And I think the distinction that the court needs to focus on is these are sophisticated commercial transactions.
Does Floorcraft control this case at all, in your view?
I believe Floorcraft does control this case. This court held in Floorcraft that in that circumstance, the contractor had no cause of action against an engineering firm with which it did not have
in
a contract.
Tort.
Now, they argued, Haddonview, and said, but there is a sufficient nexus here because of the fact that the engineer on that project had some control over what was happening on the project site. And this court said, that's not enough. The economic loss rule applies, and you cannot recover purely economic loss in the absence of damage to person or property in tort. You have to rely upon your contract. And that really is the quintessential element of the economic loss doctrine and why we need it in Ohio, because parties bargain for and allocate their risks and they price their contracts accordingly. To go back to your example, Justice Pfeiffer, if in fact you're going to impose tort liability on a subcontractor in this scenario, are you also going to say that at that point in time, he has the right to go back and reprice the work to include that risk? That's why the bargain for allocation of risk and cost is so protected by the majority of courts and the U.S. Supreme Court. If you look at what the U.S. Supreme Court said
You've used your time, Mr. Curry.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Schneider.
Thank you, Chief Justice, members of the court. Let me first respond, if I can, to Justice Lasinger's question. This is on pleadings, by the way, as Justice Pfeiffer noted. And yes, Section B was in part stricken as part of the negotiations. However, time is of the essence. That was not stricken in these provisions. And the contract was supplemented by two specific addenda, Exhibits B and Exhibit C, both of which require a 27-week completion schedule. And if you look at Schedule C, and again, I can't implore enough, this is a 12C standard. Shook chose not to, apparently, on these pleadings and on this record as it's constituted, to strike time as of the essence, nor to strike the 27-week substantial completion, which was amended by non-boilerplate document. To further say, I'm coming before this court. I am not here to undermine the economic loss doctrine. The economic loss doctrine has validity in this jurisdiction.
Counsel,
and, yes.
As I understand the Court of Appeals decision, they seem to hold that DSI can sue directly because they were an intended beneficiary. Is that correct?
I don't know exactly what the thought process was, frankly, of the 10th District. The 10th District, I think it's on page 19 and 20 of the decision, did a leapfrog. Admittedly, it did a leapfrog. What it did was the court said, because Shook knew that DSI was a incidental beneficiary, I think was the term, that therefore DSI became foreseeable. And the problem
now,
with that.
The problem yes. I have with that argument is that every single construction contract, the owner is the incidental beneficiary. The interlocking directory shouldn't matter.
Right.
That holding in this case seems to now allow every single contractor owner to sue directly the subcontractors.
I agree that you could read the decision that way. I'm sure that Mr. Curry...
You can't read it. They say that.
Well, I think what the court...
It's not just reading it. They say that.
This court can... I think the court can clarify, and by the way, I'm in favor of Forecraft, as it's written. There's a reasoned exception to the economic loss doctrine, and I'll get to that. But this court can affirm very easily, because I think what happened here is that the 10th District... really, in effect, thought or acted as though Haddonview modified Forecraft. Really, Forecraft obviously modified Haddonview. It came much later. And you can't be foreseeable unless there's a sufficient nexus.
What is the difference here? The fact that your two companies had interlocking directories?
No.
Is that the difference? Is that what allows them to let DSI sue directly?
No. First of all, we can sue Corporex. We have that remedy. We believe, have the remedy to pursue Shook directly because of Forecraft. When Forecraft, you have to go back to the 30s, but I think it was Justice Cardozo that talked about the economic loss doctrine. You generally don't have a tort duty.
Ignore Forecraft. Give me the legal principle. Why can you sue directly? Don't tell me
Because on this record, as constituted, which is the complaint and the exhibits, and by the way, Justice O'Donnell, the contract was appended, who asked that question, on the answer, on the counterclaim coupled with the complaint, and then DSI's reply to the answer, on this record, there is a nexus sufficient to meet the Forecraft exception for privity.
What is that nexus?
Nexus is defined as an interrelation and a relationship and ties and linkage. And in this case, we have a subcontract that is replete, Your Honor, with duties that Shook undertook that run in favor of DSI to repair within 1 year and guarantee work for 1 year.
That's not the issue, because you're suing for delay and damages, not come back and repair.
Well,
a separate cause of action for come back and fix this, and you didn't fix it. But you're asking for delay and damages, correct?
But nexus can't be. I could be totally wrong on this, and this court's going to tell me if I'm wrong in whatever appropriate time, but I don't think that this court analyzes the relationship between the parties. In other words, you have a contract, and I agree there should be a boundary between tort law and contract law, and that ought to be a certain boundary. But the economic loss rule has a well-reasoned exception that uses the tools of tort. And it says that if there is a sufficient nexus or relationship between the parties such that a plaintiff is not remote and the consequences aren't unforeseeable, that in that case, in those limited circumstances, in that limited carve-out, where there's a high bar and the court has the tools of tort, using foreseeability and nexus, someone can pursue certain claims.
So if the owner and the contractor owned by the same company, they're the only ones that can now sue a subcontractor directly.
No, that's not the case. What I'm saying is, the nexus, Your Honor, is between Dublin Suites and the subcontractor Shook. The nexus is not between, it doesn't matter whether Corporex is an affiliated corporation as the prime contractor with the owner. There could be no association between the owner and the prime contractor other than the prime contractor.
But that's not what the Court of Appeals said. They said because you guys owned each other, then Shook knew who the intended beneficiary was.
That's why I'm here admitting that the 10th District's could be read as somehow wreaking havoc on the construction industry, but my point is you can affirm because on this record and on these what's in front of you, there is a overwhelmingly sufficient nexus between Dublin Suites and Shook. Forget the prime contractor here.
How does that serve the state of the law for the entire state and similarly situated parties? You're asking us to take a look at this on the very narrow facts of this case, and if that's the theory, we shouldn't even be hearing this case.
I'm not frankly asking that you hear it on this. I mean, this was a 12C judgment on the pleadings motion that was filed by Shook. The trial court threw out all of Shook's, or all of Dublin Suites' claims against Shook. And the Court of Appeals reinstated two of those, our negligence claim against Shook, We've talked about that with Justice Stratton here. The reasoning's a little vague in that case, and also the implied warranty claim. Evidence hasn't been developed below. I mean, we go down, we may get, Mr. Curry may be filing a Rule 56 and we may be out. They may show that there isn't foreseeability or that there wasn't some sufficient nexus. And I am not advocating that every owner, in fact, I think most owners, if this court affirms and affirms with clarification and applies nexus, which are the tools of tort, I mean, it's the brief that Mr. Curry filed in this case talking about empty terms, that foreseeability and nexus are empty terms and that they're elastic, is frankly insulting to the trial courts and appellate courts that apply those terms all the time.
They're not empty terms if we adopt, and I guess I would say continue the view that the parties can apportion the risk in a contract. And that's what they did here, did they not? I mean, all this nexus talk seems to me that that's the way you get to tort, but we don't really need to get to tort, do we? If the contract, these are sophisticated, at least their lawyers are sophisticated lawyers representing the parties. They wrote the contracts. And clearly, in one place, we can see that they paid attention because they crossed out certain language. Why should we leave that very basic fundamental doctrine of law to try to fit this, I don't know if it's unusual, but this arrangement between the owner and the general contractor here to try to make a remedy for them when general contract principles don't seem to apply?
Well, two responses to that. First of all, applying the economic loss doctrine strictly, which would mean DSI would not have any claims, the economic loss doctrine is to be applied to unforeseeable plaintiffs. That was the purpose that for which the rule is, so that there aren't remote consequences to unforeseeable plaintiffs. Now, if you determine on the pleadings, if you can read Exhibit A to the complaint and Exhibit A to the answer and counterclaim, along in pari materia, Chief Justice, with Exhibits B and C, and this court can come to the conclusion as a matter of law, which it has the ability to do interpretively as a matter of law de novo, that delay claims were in effect stricken from the contract and that DSI no longer would not have any remedy, then that answers the question for you that you just posed to me. Well, but I think that Exhibit C,
they have
a
remedy, don't they? Have a remedy against Corporex, the general contractor, the general basic contract law. But here, because the parties are owned by the same person, well, that apparently didn't make much sense.
Yeah, so. And my response is that they do have a remedy against, DSI has a remedy against the prime, but I also believe it has a remedy directly through the prime and to the sub for the reasons that I think there is this association between the sub and the owner in this particular case that is sufficient to supply nexus, which is sufficient for the well-reasoned exception to the Floorcraft rule. And so I don't think in this case the economic loss doctrine.
Counsel, your argument and your position is the underpinning of all of that is that we have to read the contracts.
I think
and that in the contracts we find references to direct obligations by the sub to the owner of the building.
Your Honor, that is correct. And you also have a reservation of rights to the owner in the subcontract. We talk about sophisticated parties. Shook didn't negotiate out the reservation that the owner had to walk on this subcontract and to make changes in the field and to receive the benefit of the savings that any of those changes made. Now, that is not the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel case, which is the infamous economic loss rule where I get into a fender bender in a tunnel and everybody's backed up in the back of the tunnel, somebody doesn't get to work and somebody ends up losing their job. That's unforeseeable. But in this case, Shook entered into a contract, presumably with its eyes wide open, and there are rights reserved to the owner. If those are illusory provisions in the subcontract, then what is Dublin Suites' remedy? Why put them in there if Dublin Suites can't benefit?
But those sort of things exist in almost every contract between subs and contractors and generals. Those reservations of rights are standard language. And so far, no other case has held that gives the general owner a direct action against the sub because they have the right to change the project and add and detract to the project. That's, I'm having trouble with that leap, giving them the right to sue directly.
They can sue directly if this court finds there's a sufficient relationship between the parties.
I don't have a problem with the DSI under that one, I think it was paragraph K, going back on post-warranty. You know, you occupy the building, you get a crack in the wall, you go back and say, fix the crack. But that doesn't seem to be the case here. That doesn't seem to be the argument. Here is you want lost profits, and you don't want to sue Corporex for them. You want to sue the sub for them, even though the language was stricken from the contract.
But dwelling for a moment on Section K, if that's the provision on the owner guarantee, what? First of all, couldn't that be fairly read by this court as a duty undertaken by Shook to repair at no obligation for 1 year at no cost to the owner? If that, the purpose of the economic loss rule, again, is to keep people to their contracts.
There's a difference between repairing and giving him damages because you couldn't occupy the building properly.
And that's a huge difference. And that's the second response that I have. And that response is, Your Honor, that if I can read between the lines here, I'm not really should do that, but you could. It's possible then that you could have nexus. The court could determine nexus to pursue one claim, but find insufficient nexus to pursue another claim. And I don't believe that's the case. I think you either have nexus or you don't. And if you have a sufficient nexus, then I think the well-reasoned exception to the economic loss rule applies, and that a foreseeable plaintiff in such relationship with a subcontractor, in this case, should not be barred the opportunity to recover purely economic loss. In the Cleveland construction case, the 8th District did that, and it distinguished Floorcraft by saying that the design professional had, they were there. I mean, DSI is no stranger to this subcontract. I see the lights on. 2 minutes, is that what, 2 minutes?
About 1 minute, actually.
1 minute. Really. Thank you, Your Honor. The other issue, if this court can affirm because, one, a 12C standard should be applied, and the inferences on the pleadings and the allegations should be drawn in favor of the appellee here. Now, Mr. Curry made mention of Corporex and DSI, the affiliated entities, had somehow contracted away certain rights when there was final payment. I don't think that the prime contract's in the record or in the pleadings, but I can tell you that his statement is not entirely correct, because there are exceptions to that. I won't get into that. This court twice on two occasions, one written by Justice Pfeiffer and not terribly long ago, has also this court has found that absent privity, an owner can pursue a concrete supplier on implied warranty theories, and the 10th District Court of Appeals determined that that was appropriate in this case. And the argument that has been raised, although it wasn't raised orally here by Mr. Curry, but it was certainly contained in the brief, is that this court ought to draw some distinction between a commercial consumer and a non-commercial consumer. And I don't see the distinction there. How do you define commercial and non-commercial, and what about the mom and pops? And isn't the public policy here to pursue implied warranty claims so that repairs get made before there's catastrophic events and personal injuries? So I would ask that the court consider affirming the 10th District on the implied warranty claim. And I would ask that this court, using the 12BC standard, determine that on this record, based on those provisions in the subcontract, that the relationship of the parties in this case really mirrors the Cleveland construction case, CleveCon, and the UTT Williams case, and say that in this case and on these facts at this juncture, which is before we've gotten into the evidence, at this juncture, Dublin Suites there's enough of a nexus here sufficient to allow it to overcome the economic loss bar and to pursue its claims and see where those claims take us. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Mr. Curry, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. The 10th District's foreseeable plaintiff test simply doesn't work because there are no limits. Simple example, Polaris Mall. We know that under the Mechanics Lien Act, notice of commencement has to be filed, identifies the owner, foreseeable plaintiff. Prior to that project kicking off, virtually every major tenant in that mall was publicly identified. Are they a foreseeable plaintiff? If Lazarus couldn't open or Lord and Taylor couldn't open, they're now a foreseeable plaintiff. In regard
Counsel,
to the-
if I understand Mr. Snyder's argument, he believes that the Court of Appeals should be affirmed, but that we really should not adopt their logic and reasoning, that their opinion is wrong. They got the right answer. That's what I take him to be saying, but for some poorly stated reasons.
Well, I think given the public policy that underlies the economic loss doctrine, the Court of Appeals got it wrong, period, regardless of the logic. If this court adopts anything that the 10th District did.
But we're still at the pleading stage. And I mean, do we have to read the contracts that are in the pleadings and to...
That's our point. I don't think you ever had to get into reading the contracts. The reason why we pointed out that the contracts were modified to eliminate that liability was simply to point out that if you assert a tort cause of action, whatever the parties negotiated is out the window in terms of liability. I don't think you need to get there. I think what we're asking this court to do is say in a commercial context where you have sophisticated parties, the parties are left to the contractual allocation of risk that they negotiated when they signed a contract. I don't know how a contractor prices the risk that comes with tort liability that's only determined after the fact. How in a commercial context does a contractor do that? One thing I'll leave you with on the implied warranty, I think the court got that wrong as well. Under the Barton case, which is a 10th District case, where you have contractual warranties provided in the contracts, implied warranty has no application at all. It shouldn't even be in this case at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Curry. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.